Hi, this is Ms. G. I am back with my story tonight. And tonight's story is a continuation of my theme last week of She Rose, where I told stories then about women in our lives who make us just want to strive for more and help us get to our goals and our dreams. And tonight's story definitely centered on that. It's titled A Lasting Gift by J.D. McKay. She placed her old Motorola flip phone down on the coffee table and tried to disappear into the security and comfort of her aging, overstuffed couch. Eve was driven towards success, but envious moments like this could only be cured with Ben and Jerry's and lots of it. This had been another stressful week for her, and she desperately needed to stop judging her own abilities and gifts as inadequate. Like some of us, Eve had to believe she was not of lesser worth. Eve's grandmother always told her to think happy thoughts or to go to a happy place if she felt sad. Grandma's happy place was a garden. Everything in Grandma's imaginary garden was glorious and beautiful all the time. When Eve was a child, she had little difficulty believing in Grandma's happy place. But her grandmother had passed away some 10 years ago, and Eve was all alone. Eve caught hold of these pleasant childhood memories. They began to overtake her. She stopped feeling down about herself, and sleep carried her away. Eve dreamt of a pastoral place, a long-distant echo just outside a garden wall. She could smell the sweetest blending of botanical aromas carried on the breeze. It wafted over the extremely high garden wall. Again, she was breathing in a precious essence from Grandma's garden. Coming more awake in her dream, Eve scanned the vine-covered wall. There were many flowers like lemon lace, Aunt D, wisteria, and trumpets like Madame Galan, and Grandma's favorite, Indian summer. All these beauties were interwoven with the mixed colors of morning glories. The garden wall seemed to go on forever, and a little way off was a thick garden door. Three strangers came up a common path and approached this old weathered door. One came near the door as if in worship, chanting and praying. The next stranger recited memorized passages from a holy book. The third stranger uttered nothing at all. Each in their turn stepped forward and knocked on the door. The result for their effort was the same. A scratching or scraping noise from the garden side of the door was heard. The sound started about midway and continued down to the bottom of the door, where a key was pushed out upon the ground for the petitioner. The keys appeared similar, as if to open a common lock, but it was the type of metallurgy that seemed to capture the greatest attention and interest. One key was made of pure gold and another of fine silver, while the last key was formed from common iron. The gold key recipient immediately separated from the other two petitioners, turning her back to them, acting honored or elevated in doing so. The gold key recipient just walked away in a show of newly found superiority. The silver key recipient walked away from the iron key recipient almost as superior in attitude and manner as had the gold key recipient. Eve turned to see the remaining stranger. She identified with the devastation and confusion of the iron key recipient. Heartbroken and alone, he began to cry, and Eve along with him. He was feeling very much abandoned and worthless. The iron key recipient finally pulled a length of soft rawhide from his shirt and used it to hang his key from his neck. Silently and sadly, he walked away from the bulky garden door. Eve watched as four more groups of strangers came to the garden entrance and performed their rituals for a key. There seemed to be no discernible pattern as to how a particular type of key was dispensed. Gender and age didn't matter. Worshipping or just knocking didn't make any difference. No one knew what kind of key would be awarded or why. Eve tried to place meaning to what had transpired, and she was confused at her own growing curiosity, because she wanted to approach that old wooden door. She wanted to knock. She wanted her chance at the prize. Gold fever finally took control, and she stepped up, knocking lightly. At first, nothing happened, but then the familiar sound from the backside of the door heading down. In anticipation, she crossed her fingers and closed her eyes tight until the noise stopped. The excitement rushed in her veins like a gambler on a winning streak. Finally, Eve looked down. There at her feet was an iron key. Eve's anger flared suddenly. I didn't even get a silver key. Her head began to spin, and the rejection made her dizzy. Eve classified and judged herself. My key is not as good as the gold or silver keys, and I guess neither am I. Her knees lost strength and folded beneath her. She fell against the weathered wood, and the weight of Eve's body slid down the rough surface. She felt the splinters tugging at her clothes and needling into her flesh. She hit the ground hard, palms open, fingers spread apart. Her left shoulder took the brunt of the slivers, and her misery was compounded. Deep sadness extinguished her previous dream of joy. Why, Grandma? Why didn't you tell me the truth about this place? Sobbing deeply seemed to lance to open the last wells of envious poison in Eve's soul. She regained her natural strength and wiped the humiliation from her eyes. She retrieved the iron key with a sigh of resignation. Eve reached for the gate handle to pull her aching body upright again. It was then that she saw a tiny glint of light through a hole. Suppressing the pain from her shoulder, she knelt closer to be sure. There was a small keyhole hidden beneath the shadow of the gate's iron handle. Amidst the growing excitement wailing within her chest was an unmistakable vibration or whisper. Eve felt her grandmother's voice firm and gentle, draining and healing her wounded soul. My darling child, where are your happy thoughts? Your gifts are like these keys, different yet equal. Consider them and don't be ashamed or proud like the others. Remember, you are loved in ways difficult for natural eyes to see, and you may sometimes feel like you're on your own, but you are never, ever truly alone, my darling girl. In that precious moment, Eve came to understand Grandma's message. Eve's talents and gifts, whether gold, silver, or iron, were the keys to unlocking her future happiness. If she believed, if she employed them. She remembered that all the keys were cut identical. While some keys were silver and others of iron or gold, those keys were no better for the job than Eve's own iron key. Cool in her hand, Eve originally had missed the point and purpose of the door key entirely. As in life, rewards come to all key holders not too proud or too ashamed of their gifts. The unknown rewards, adventures, and possibilities which lay beyond the garden door could be had by all key bearers. Eve brought the key up to meet the lock and gently slid it into place, meeting no resistance at all. Eve's courage was restored. She gave her iron key a little turn, applying pressure, and click, the lock released. This garden door is unlocked. Oh, thank you, Grandma. I'm coming. Pressing her thumb firmly on the final latch, she released it. All the excitement made her heart race as Eve heard the hinges creak loudly and felt the old gate door open. Eve held her breath as her dreams rushed at her. Now life would be sweet. Another familiar sound demanded Eve's attention. An unnatural noise to this place invaded her ears. Instantly, Eve was brought from her realistic dream state to the vibrating and chirping of her cell phone on the coffee table. Trying to hold fast to her dream, she let the call go to voicemail, but too late. Eve's dream time was shattered and she awoke, resisting the reality that her world was exactly the same as when she had drifted off to sleep. Deep disappointment began to set in. She despaired again, and she thought how fleeting and unreal dreams can be. Eve's tears were sadly flowing as she turned to sit up from the couch. Her shoulder reminded her in terms of raw pain what couldn't be. Frozen in place, she felt the soft rawhide tugging at her neck. Like a pendulum, it swung from her chest and back again, cold at every touch. Hanging just above her healing heart was Eve's beautiful iron key. One of Grandma's lasting gifts. A lesson more precious than rubies, and like Eve herself, worth more than silver or gold. You've just heard me read A Lasting Gift by J.D. McKay. I hope you enjoyed that story. This is Ms. G, and I'm bringing you Left Hanging here at 104.3 Juneau, Alaska. And I will be right back. Stay tuned. This is Ms. G, and I'm back with Left Hanging. And I have time for another story for you. It's by Linnea Johnson, and it's titled Uterus. She called me Uterus. I think she meant to call me Eunice, but she didn't. She named me Uterus. But then she spoke of my father as if he were a revolver. She'd say, "You know, Uterus, a man of your father's caliber." And he... And she would go on to describe him, long and stout, hair trigger. He was 45 years old when I was born, but not my mother. She was 63 and still had regular menses, as she would announce to the butcher. She noticeably oiled her body as if she were a weightlifter. "Got leather cupcakes for boobs," she'd say. And she was proud of me, prouder still of having had me when she did. Photos show, and I remember her holding me up, showing me off like a Campbell's commercial, might a fine new can of soup, me all dolled up in lace and what looked like doilies. The ivory baby. She'd said I looked like the ivory flakes baby. One Friday night when my mom and dad and I had settled onto the living room couch for an evening's television, she said she thought she should be the one in the filmy nighty gown selling Frigidaires on that evening game show. "Your dad, well, Uterus, he could be up on a horse selling Marlboros, he's so good-looking." She lit one up, sucked the filtered end of it, then tongued off the lipstick she left on it. "He could sell them mounted on a burro. What a man. Found them on top of a burrito. Right, Daddy?" She nudged at him from behind me. But Daddy got up, twisted the center of his boxer shorts over to his left so nothing would fall out the seam slip, and went on to the kitchen for a beer, wishing we were watching the fights instead of that evening game show. Better, anyway, than the pop tune countdown show, I think he thought. I watched the nylon freeze markings on the backs of his one-muscle thighs as he walked away from us. My mother squashed out the Marlboro on the inner pink of the conch shell with legs she used for an ashtray. She mostly didn't smoke. This was a Friday night during the spring. I was 7. My father would have been 52 by then in that case. It was coming up on my mother's 70th birthday. She thought she was pregnant again, wanted it, spent most of the balmy April nights ironing my old baby flannel things. My mother said, "It's your..." My father said, "It's your imagination," to which my mother replied, "That's what you said about her," meaning me. Is she my imagination? For a long time, I thought I was, or might be just that, but then she wasn't talking to me, so I didn't have to pretend to know the answer. My father wouldn't answer. My mother would stroke her belly, really raise her blouse or t-shirt to stroke her belly. Early that April, she'd set up the ironing board in the living room next to the couch to one side of the TV, so she could be with us while she could still be ironing all my old baby clothes. She hummed and sang. I thought she was beautiful, her full face and indecision of skin and bone. She stood me up on an orange crate next to her, put the iron on low heat, and taught me the intricate art of ironing. First the sleeves, then the back, then the collar, around any buttons, then each of the front sides. There were long sacks like Sweet Pea wore in the cartoons. I liked those best. Those in the tiny white flannel head caps with the narrow pastel satin ties, which the point of the iron uncurled, flattened, and made shimmery and lank as a piece of weighted tinsel. She told me what I had been like in each thing we ironed, what a cute baby head I'd had, and how exactly it fitted in her hand, heavy back weight of it in the cup of her palm. She would hold out her hand and look at it, form it to what she remembered to have been there, my cute baby head. And never once did you spit up. That's how happy you were. We were ironing the bibs. She'd embroidered the ducks and dragons on them herself. I never iron, do I? This is special. Fill this belly, full of somebody who will really like these clothes. For ironing the sheet, she put her hand over mine, and we sailed the stripes and bears of their length and breadth. You were the damnedest sweet baby, long enough and coming, uterus. They put you up to my breast that first time. You damn near sucked it off. What a kid. We ironed, back and forth. Then we folded. My father would sit on the couch and watch the succession of commercials and programs. She jiggled her fingers through my ginger curls. Tell her she's quite a kid, Papa. Ooh, Mama. He would. Somebody asked me the other day if there were trees there in South Chicago when and where I grew up. I remember there had been light poles, general timber utility poles, which had been treated with something, creosote maybe, from the ground up about 6 feet. Around such things was always a brown mat of weeds and wads of variously decomposing dog poo. Sparrows seemed to live on the wires in alternating shifts with other darker birds. Pigeons were further downtown and along the L tracks where stood the penny red peanut machines. Peanuts for them, chiclets front tooth gum for us. The little square glass machines sat side by side. It was robins my mother looked for that spring and each earlier spring that I could remember. Head out the window, face the searchlight, my mother wouldn't rest until she'd seen a robin. There must have been something besides telephone wires for them to sit on. There must have been trees. I simply don't remember the sense of trees when I was a kid. Nothing of the leafy blessing they are to me now, though young and short as I was then. Perhaps my mother was all the tree I needed or noticed then. If they were there, trees and birds, they had to have been hardy creatures. My mother. That sky was a mix of steel shards and alkaline dust, molten petroleum vapors, ship exhaust, and airborne waterway sewage. I remember sky and some snow is red, gray mostly. I don't remember anyone in my neighborhood raking leaves. Laundry hung up to dry in the basement, sheets stiff from the lack of breeze, gray as if they'd been dried outside. For me, if spring wasn't the sight of new leaf trees, it was the sight of an apartment full of lace curtains stretched on wood and nail frames drying in the basement. The apartment was nice. It had windows that opened, sash cords mostly intact. We lived up a flight, so we weren't eyeball to eyeball with the street traffic, which wasn't then what it would be now. Then it was mostly kids on scooters or hefting bats, swearing a little, smoking in alleys as dust swirled around their gym shoes. The Robert Hall sign, a block up the street from our 5 rooms, stayed on all night, so we really saved on electricity, as my father liked to point out to my mother, reconfirming repeatedly his choice of a place to live, I guess. The lake was pretty close, though the park preceding the lake overshadowed the joys of the lake for me when I was a kid. The swings were, after all, not out in the water, but in the park's sparse grass. The harbor was closer than the lake or the park. Unfortunately, though I like to watch the tankers spill oil and take on wheat and occasionally blow up from the bulk or dust of it. The brewery grain elevators went up more frequently, but they were farther down the skyway. Kids who lived farther south on the east side could watch, feel, and smell the shell oil tanks blow up way over in East Chicago, Indiana. But I couldn't see that from just a second-floor apartment in South Chicago. But the whole southern rim of the poorer lake neighborhoods went to the same park, and from the WPA stone walls, we could all sit and watch the steel mills red up the sky summer nights when it was too hot to do anything else in or outside any apartment. My mother acted like she really liked the place, putting up gardenia wallpaper 1 year, painting the kitchen a robin's egg blue another time. She dusted windowsills and seemed to look forward to washing and stretching and then rehanging the lace curtains every spring. It had a bedroom and a little sun porch off the dining room, which had always been my room. It was a wonderful spring and fall, though in Chicago the other two seasons were rougher and a good deal longer. The kitchen had a porcelain sink on legs with a window over it. She polished the chrome legs of the kitchen table and put an oilcloth over it, each tablecloth lasting until it cracked, chipped, and wore through to the bare weave. I liked the back porch stairway best, and like I said, the windows opened. So this April we spent ironing baby clothes. My father's skeptical. My mother nearly 70 and growing a belly which was hard and thumped like a watermelon. She sewed seersucker slacks for herself, an accordion fan of material up from the crotch to the waist to accommodate the growth, a string inside the waistband to be tied in a neat bow above her belly button. She sewed a couple extra pair because of the vacation my father had been planning and which, no matter when she was due, she said she wouldn't let nothing spoil. She kept the sewing machine on the sun porch, so as it was my bedroom, I was in on much of the sewing of her clothes. "This vacation's for your dad. He works hard, he does," she'd say, the pump of the sewing machine pushing the sweet smell of machine oil up into my room. Out of my sight, maybe, but I'd never seen him lift a finger in the 7 years I'd been alive. "Feel this kid uterus. Here's the head." She always wanted me to touch the outside for the baby inside, but I only would when she would take my hand, her hand on top of it, and move my hand over the thing like the way the Navy moves a mine sweep over the Pacific. I couldn't feel or hear anyone kick or move or hum. She said she could hear the baby hum, sing some things. Like little tunes, Onward Christian Soldiers was one tune she could hear the baby singing. She would cock her head, ear down towards her belly, eyes closed until she could pick up the tune. Nod her head to the beat and join in. "Yes, your father has always wanted to go westering. This is the year we're going to do it. They get restless, men do. So it's you and me and the baby and your dad." Sometimes she would press the side of my head to her. Could I at least hear the water slosh, she would ask of me. I couldn't, and I felt disobedient for the first time in my life. My father sided with me, and I didn't like that either. I loved my mother very much. Her birthday was June 12th. That June 12th, she would be 70. My father and I took the bus down to Roseland to shop. Mother knew all the stuff at the Robert Hall and at the South Chicago Sears store, he said. We had to go elsewhere. He didn't know what to get her, and I felt strange going anywhere without her. I told him to get her a filmy nightgown, and I wanted, please, some hot cashews if they had a nut counter anywhere in Roseland, half as nice as the nut counter in the Sears store by our house. It was at this point my father decided to tell me just how old 70 was to him and that you can stop ironing them baby clothes. "Nothing in there she's going to bring home from a hospital," he said, his hand around my waist at the five and dime store soda counter. "Want a chocolate phosphate?" Just then a lady who looked like she sold things sat down next to him, and he kissed her. "Beatrice, meet Felicia Olander." He called me the wrong name, or maybe I just didn't recognize my name in his mouth being handed as if it were on a platter to this eggplant-faced woman who laid her arm across my daddy's belly like it was a guard pole from a Ferris wheel seat at Riverview, her hand wiggling its fingers as if they were zealous worms trying to track a fish. My hand, in this case. "How do you do?" I said. My mother's daughter, always polite. "Who's she?" I said, growing up. But he turned towards her, and I ran away to see which of the parakeets were alive, which of the fish, my face hot, wet, and as distended as my mother's belly, me there in a strange store in a strange part of the world. I couldn't get home without him, though then and there I did rehearse my address and phone number, should I be able to find one of the nice policemen my mother had always told me I could rely on if I ever found myself lost. If ever I was lost, it was then. Eventually, I went back to the soda counter, but I couldn't look at him ever again, and I didn't. I saw him for years, of course. He and Felicia raised me after my mother died, and months short of her 70th birthday, no baby inside her. All those baby clothes ironed, folded, waiting. When she went away to the hospital in pain early that May, I readied everything should she and the baby, or she, or just the baby come home. If it were only the baby, I could raise it alone. Quiet as it was inside her, it would be no trouble. I already knew how to iron. I could probably sew from watching her. My mother and I were so close. Maybe she taught me everything I already needed to know. We'd be fine. I would name it Robin. I managed to tuck most of those clothes into the clothes end of my mother's casket. Felicia, who really was pregnant, wasn't going to get my mother's work. Not if I could help it, and I could. That April day, Felicia bought me hot cashews and chocolate candy, none of which I ate. She helped my father pick out a house dress for my mother. "Save the receipt," Felicia said to my dad. When I got home, my mother thought I was sick. She took me from my father's grip, felt my forehead, and bundled me off to a hot bath. She dug through my drawers and retrieved from the winter things last year's flannel jammies, which after she towelled me off, she dressed me in. By that time, it was getting dark, and my father had gone out to get some beer for evening television. That night, my mother and I sat in the big old chair by the front room window, and I told her I could hear the baby singing. What was she going to name the baby, and was it going to be another girl like me or just a boy? She sang, "Uterus, there will never be another you," and said, "But it's a girl. Why, we've got enough trouble in this world without bringing into it one more boy. I wouldn't have one, would you?" She had beautiful full lips, my mother did, creased from years of lipstick, talk, and kissing, she liked to say. She was warm that night as we sat squeezed together in the chair, me flanneled over and her in her old thick plaid robe, which always smelled to me like we had dogs. She told me the story of the baby alligators people bring home from Florida, and then when they get too big for the bathtubs, people flush them down toilets. The ones who survive all grow up in sewers. She'd grown up an orphan, she said, and had always felt like a half-grown baby alligator, but crawling out of the sewer onto the streets. She laughed and showed me the skin on her neck to prove her alligatorness, the intricate wrinkles of the skin on the top of her hands at rest. "What do you think?" she asked me as she snapped her hands together, palm of one on top of the other, imitating an alligator mouth. "Scary?" "No," I said. But that night I was scared. She laughed and said she crawled around the world a couple times, sometimes on her belly, sometimes on her back. "Had a ball," she said, "had a ball." She left the lights off that night, allowing the Robert Hall dark to filter in and until we were to each other what was pure sound, our bodies pushed together in that chair and joined as if we were one again. But then I turned 60, and I'd done everything but have myself you. So at 60, she decided to marry someone, seeing as she'd not done that before, and given that she thought she would like to have me. She found my father and never found him out. He clerked shoes at the Weebolt. She had accumulated a little what she called nest egg that provided just about exactly her half the rent and utilities. So after she had me, she didn't go back to sterilizing surgical instruments at South Chicago Hospital, or selling tickets to the coal mine ride at the Museum of Science and Industry, or back to any of the other ways she spent the first 6 years of her life. She liked to think she was the only one on Social Security pension who had their own born 7-year-old. That April night, she rocked me almost to sleep, my head falling from her shoulder to her big belly. I told her I could hear the baby singing when the moon comes over the mountain, just like a teeny Kate Smith. I said, too, she had a filmy nightgown coming as her birthday present. She fluffed my hair, tipped my face up to her with two ruby-red fingernails and said, "You know, uterus, I feel like a whole carton of cigarettes. I'm so lucky." You've been listening to me read Linnea Johnson's Uterus. This is Ms. G, and I'm bringing you Left Hanging, and until next time, good night.